and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Mickey Myers. Mickey Myers is a graduate of Carnegie Mellon University and the University of Pittsburgh, where she's taught poetry and literature since 1994. Her book, Trigger Finger, won the Pearl Poetry Prize, and she has received 3 Pushcart Prize nominations. She lives with her family in Squirrel Hill and can be found online at mickeymyers.com. Hi, Mickey. How are you?
Hi, Jen. I'm good, thanks.
It's good to have you on. You've had your book, Trigger Finger, out for a while, and we've been wanting to get you on Prosody. So you're going to start with some poems from Trigger Finger,
right? That's right, yes.
Okay.
This one's called Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. After a while, it was easier just to let the mosquitoes eat you. Sitting flashlight in hand on the steps of a cabin after lights out, all you could hear were children getting up to mischief. When exhaustion caught up with them, laughter and music drifted up from the mess hall down the hill, from people having more fun than you. It was hard not to pick out voices, determine who was flirting with whom. Some nights, if the air was very still, raceway engines ground out their rhythm of laps and dust from out beyond town. In between circuits, they turned up Neil Young over the loudspeakers, and if you listen not with your ears, but with the pores of your raw and swollen skin, you could almost hear the sound of ripe watermelon being cracked open, its crimson flesh sold under the bleachers to all comers, 50 cents a handful. This is Sweet Nothings. It's about the little candy hearts that you see at Valentine's Day. It's about the guy who makes the candy hearts. The candy heart maker works 16 hours a day. He reads the red endearments to himself under the roar of the machine. How are you? He asks no one. Dial my number. When the hearts turn him down, shake on past to the next pair of greasy hands, he shakes his head, no way. At night, he changes light bulb in an office building downtown. He whispers sweet nothings to them when no one else can hear. Say yes, tell me, on fire. You can hear him at the bar, his hands clasped tight around a beer. All right, hint, hint, gotcha, so fine. He takes them home to his girl, but they're not free. 3 for a buck, and still they make him pay. Say no, you bet. Go away. After dinner, her face folds itself into a fist while he tries to pull a pack from his pocket, making conversation before clearing the dishes away. 2 years and nothing seems to change. He's so tired, he can't think of anything to say. On the way out, she asks him if he's more than just his sweetheart, and he says, I hope, cutie pie, your tops be mine. When he looks up, his true love's gone, and there's no one but himself to break the silence. He wants to tell her how much he loves her, but can't adjust the machine. This is Formula One. The dial tells the same old story. Down another pound and me with nothing to lose. I force a pastry down, and while waiting for the blood to leave my brain, ponder the body's lean insistence on food. The way the circulation craves a trip around the loop, only it seems to make me stupid. Today I saw my ribs waving their checkered flags and all my senses rushed on for a pit stop in my stomach. Gas, a tire change, multivitamin, new set of shocks. The dial tells the same old story. Down another pound, 110 laps to go. When the blood heads up again, I'll be so sharp, I'll be aerodynamic. This is the last one from the book where I get the trigger finger from. It's called Horizon Anywhere. Sometimes I think these crossbeams don't read barcodes, but me. These hands don't feel good for nothing but punching keys, 10 hours at register number 3 because Dozy turned up late. Nights, I just want to make them do something beautiful. Every day, the same simple gestures over and over again. There's nothing much out here but an endless horizon of asphalt and sky. I'd walk away, but the paycheck keeps calling my name. The road I live on's got to lead to someone with a better view than this. I have a friend said he'd loan me his gun any time I like. You can pretend you're anywhere if you close your eyes. Inside, we have red lights for meat and green lights for greens. We have artificial moisture environments with concealed water sprays. We have the lights on all day. Josie didn't want to show no on the bruises, but I saw them anyway. 15 stitches, one for each time she threatened to leave. How much are any of us worth, anyway? I pass my hand over the scanner, and it tells me less than a tank of gas, a beer, spare change. Now I'm the one planning to break out of here. Just drop it, she tells me. Dreams don't mean a thing. She's expecting again. Her oldest just turned 3. A car can take you anywhere. All you have to do is get in. Do it while he's asleep. Become a kite floating on the breeze. Josie, I say, please. Any time, he told me, it could be that easy. Finger on the trigger. Squeeze.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is Mickey Myers, and she's reading poems from her book, Trigger Finger. I want to ask you about how you get your poems, because it seems to me that there's always an odd angle involved or a sort of some kind of quizzical mind behind what's going on in the poems. For example, the guy who comes up with the candy hearts for Valentine's Day. I mean, things that we might never have thought of, which, you know, a lot of poetry does, but yours seems even more that way to me.
I don't like writing about the obvious things. Yeah. I like writing about those cool stories that you perhaps read and then think about 3 days later because they haven't gone away.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you know when you run into one of those moments or when you're compelled by something odd like that?
When I've looked at something and I find myself telling somebody about it. You'll never guess what I just learned, mm-hmm. because it's an interesting fact and it sticks with you. And I think those are the things that I want to make the centerpieces of what I write about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned facts, and I know you're going to read some poems related to history. And it seems to me that often your poems have some kind of factual base or historical base or... You know, there's a lot of research involved, and that's not always the case with poetry.
That's right, yeah. I realized a long time ago I didn't like writing about myself very much, so that when I wrote about other people or other situations, it was more satisfying. And perhaps it's even a better way to write about yourself, because I guess that comes out at the end of the day.
Right.
But I like being a detective. I like researching everything. So you could check the facts in the poem, and they would hold up.
Mm-hmm. And... So there's less detective work if you're writing about yourself, or?
Perhaps there's more. It's just harder.
Different kind. But, okay, well, can you read some more poems?
Sure. These are some history poems, and they all involve famous people that you've heard about, perhaps in unusual situations. And they involve sometimes anachronistic elements, things that couldn't necessarily have happened at that time, but in poetry you can make anything happen. So this one is Shakespeare watches Steve Perry play Hamlet, Southwark, 1602, and it begins with an epigraph from Hamlet. Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. Do not saw the air too much with your hand thus, but use all gently. For in the very torrent, tempest, and as I may say, whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it smoothness. The first show is, frankly, not quite what he had imagined when he put those words in Hamlet's mouth. The actor looks more like a mechanic than a prince for a start, although the leopard print shirt is a nice regal touch. It's all the prancing and emoting and wailing that confounds him, each word drawn out at the end like hot gold. To die, to sleep, but not surely with so much flicking of the hair. He trips about the stage, pausing only to deliver a line or two, eyes closed, hugging himself to convey the weary life he grunts and sweats under, before leaping up onto the scenery for the remainder of the monologue. When Ophelia asks him how his honour does for this many a day, he doesn't even look at her, but thanks the crowd instead with a hands-clasped gesture. Any minute now, they're going to start waving candles, and if they're not careful, all go up in flames. The Globe Theatre, where Shakespeare's plays were produced, did in fact burn to the ground. This one is the Earl of Essex, unsuccessfully defending his return from Ireland before the Privy Council, 29th of September 1599, and the Queen here is Queen Elizabeth I. He hadn't imagined it would be this awkward, standing there without a hat in front of everyone, being made to feel like an idiot for making peace. Sure, there had been more than the usual share of knights at the pub, and yes, on more than one occasion he'd drawn his sword as if to slay someone, but touched it to a drinking buddy's shoulders instead. "Arise, Sir Trevor, Lord Beer of Beerville," and all that. But, he told the Queen, he was a lover, not a fighter, something he was sure she'd understand. It wasn't working. He'd been given 17,000 troops to put down the rebellion with extreme prejudice and had nothing to show for it but a sissy boy truce. "Everybody was kung-fu fighting, Your Majesty," he explains. "Those cats were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening." She's not amused. "They fought with expert timing, ma'am," he offers, fingers crossed behind his back. "So far, so good. Really, you have no idea how terrifyingly funky they were." I like the music theme. I have a lot of music in my poems. This one is about Henry VIII and Tammy Wynette, because why not? And some of the titles of Tammy Wynette's songs are in this one, including in the title, "Run, Woman, Run," Hampton Court, 1533. Henry's got a wicked bad crush on Annie B, unbecoming really of a man his age. He's buying her trinkets, and she's taken to wearing his clothes as if no one would notice how they hang off her tiny frame. One day, the harpsichord is all the rage at court. Now everybody's singing along to Tammy Wynette because she's got a thing for Nashville country. Kathy's at her wit's end, but doesn't know how to do anything but stand by her man. The lawyers are scratching at the bit, gathering in hallways, humming, "Your good girl's gonna go bad," as he passes, but he doesn't take the hint. He's growing his sideburns and bedazzling all his robes with rhinestones the size of eggs. It's something he won't let go of, even after he parts his new love with her head. For now, he's content to stick it to the spies from the Holy See by whistling D-I-V-O-R-C-E. This is one about Isaac Newton, because if you're going to write about history, you have to have Isaac Newton in there. And this involves a famous record, and more the cover, the famous cover of the album, which maybe you'll recognize. 1672, Newton puts two and two together, finally. It's another dull day, and Isaac's ticking away the moments before he has to get out of bed. The housekeeper left his breakfast outside the door hours ago, a practice he insisted on to avoid being disturbed at his work, but regrets it now that his brain's all but come to a halt. Principia blew a fuse, the housekeeper's husband says, though not to his face. He hasn't a clue what a fuse is, and hopes it's not important. The sun's come out at last, and he's desperate to go. He lifts the needle off the loop where it settled after he drifted off, the scratchy whoop-whoop sound like a heartbeat coming to a halt. He can't remember how long it's been since he started putting that record on to fall asleep with at night. Splashing water on his face, he turns the mirror to catch the light, and it breaks right there in his hand. Not the mirror, the light.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Mickey Myers, reading some of her poetry. Okay, can you talk a little bit about these, I guess you could call them collisions that you have in your work between the historical and the contemporary, such as, you know, Henry VIII and Tammy Wynette? I mean, I don't think I've heard them together before.
Maybe that's why. I like putting the two things together where it says something more interesting about what you already know. Mm-hmm. We already know all of the cliches about Henry VIII. And so I don't want to rehash those. I want to see all of these people in a new light. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you use a different person or a different period of history to do that, you say something more interesting about them.
Mm-hmm. So are you motivated by a sense of play at all?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You can feel that in there. There's this other thing that you do. You said you like the music theme, but can you talk for a minute about reusing lines, almost like sampling phrases of text or popular culture in your poems, and why do that and what you hope to gain with that?
Sure. I like reading that when I read other people's poems. I like the pleasure that I get, a kind of self-satisfied pleasure, perhaps, from recognizing something, so that I can see the way the poet has woven that into their own work. And I like to leave little clues. I like to feel like I'm a detective when I'm reading. So I think that's also how I write.
Mm-hmm. So there's this sense of puzzle, it seems to me, before and during and after with your poetry. So you're leaving clues for people to do their own detective work also.
Yes, I always write without knowing what the end of the poem's going to be, because I really believe that there's no surprise for the reader if there's no surprise for the writer. So sometimes if you begin writing and you don't know where you're going to end up, it leaves room for exciting things to come into the poem. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those things are the fragments that we carry around with us that we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So how much does your own entertainment come into this? I mean, are you writing partially for your own entertainment? I mean, there's certainly work involved and craft and, you know, skill, et cetera. Is it fun for you?
It's enormous fun. Uh-huh. I'd rather be sitting here doing this than anything else. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm lucky that I get to.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I wanted to congratulate you on winning the Pearl Prize. And that's a nice prize for Trigger Finger.
Thank you.
And it's a really cool book. I want to make sure also that we mention the reading you have coming up. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. It's April's National Poetry Month, and the University of Pittsburgh Bookstore is offering a tea and verse lunchtime reading series, and I'm going to be reading there with a number of other Pitt poets on April 16th at lunchtime.
Right, and more details will be on your website, mickeymyers.com. So why don't you read more poems?
Sure. One of the things that I want to do with this history poems is not to write about the obvious thing, but I want to write about obvious people. So I wanted to include Hemingway, who's one of my favorite authors, and this is a poem that brings Hemingway into the project through a different door, and it involves the title of his one of his books that I love. It's also an astronomer, Nikolai Chernik. So this is Chernik discovers asteroid number 3656 Hemingway, Ukraine, August 31st, 1978. Nikolai has had a very good night in what will prove to be a very good couple of months as far as the discovery of asteroids goes. 21 today, so when he sits at last in the dawn's first rays to name them, he's exhausted. He racks his brains trying to remember what's been taken already, which ones he alone has immortalized in honor of a person, place, event, or thing. He smiles to think that when he started out, he couldn't imagine running out of ideas. There seemed so many to choose from. He'll have to come up with 537 before he's done. Tomorrow night, he'll discover 18 more floating between Mars and Jupiter amid the space debris that no one has yet claimed. He can't wait for the moon to rise so that he can train his lens to see. He yawns. For now, the light that hurt his eyes hides what's just beyond his reach. The sun also rises, alas, he thinks. This one is about Robert Falcon Scott, Scott of the Antarctic, who's a character that I've become very interested in because he's famous for having failed. We don't often get too many heroes who are failures. And he was famous really because he wrote a journal that was published. So he was a much better writer than he was explorer. And this is a poem that brings together two things that happened on the same day. One of them is about Scott being on the Antarctic ice shelf and dying. And one is of a barefoot boy photographed at the dockyard where they built the Titanic. So this is New Year's Day, 1912, And it starts with an epigraph by Scott from his journal. "We are very comfortable in our double tent, stick of chocolate to celebrate the new year." Very comfortable is, of course, a matter of perspective. This being the height of summer, it's all of minus 14 degrees during daylight at the South Pole, which is positively balmy compared to the cold that will kill him 3 months later, when a stick of chocolate would be as unimaginable a luxury to them as it is to the barefoot paperboy who sells the news to the black sea of workers changing shift at Harland and Wolff's Queen's Island, where 15,000 men are employed there building the Titanic and Olympic, but nary a one of them Catholic like him. He can't see the iceberg that will hit and sink the shipbuilding trade, but he can taste the troubles up ahead in Belfast, familiar as bile in the back of his throat. He looks out at the swirling snow and shivers. He's got a long way to go, and his feet are already killing him. Robert Scott's whole party died, and one of the reasons they died is they all got terrible frostbite in their feet. This one is actually about the Marlborough Man. I did a large project in which I imagined what the Marlborough Man would say if he was a real person that you could interview, and it takes on what he would say from the beginning of his career to the end. This one's from the beginning. "How hard can it be? That first shoot, oh Lord, I thought all I had to do was stand there in whatever pose they wanted, that I'd be in and out quick, laugh about being a model all the way to the bank. But you stand under hot lights for hours on end, your legs cramp, the sweat running down your back. You can't look up, scratch your nose, use the bathroom. You can't look at the camera. You have to look through the camera. You have to pretend the camera isn't there. You have to smoke until you're hoarse for continuity and look like you're enjoying a break. I couldn't help but smile, even though I wasn't happy. My face muscles just went that way, because all my life I'd been told to say cheese. In the end, they catch something like a groove, but it's just bone tiredness is all, making truce with the lens. Once, after the crew had packed up, the photographer asked me if I'd like to make a little extra on the side. I was new, didn't catch his drift. Sure, I said. It wasn't until he moved closer and asked the question that his drift caught up with me all at once and wiped the smile off my naive face." This one's from a mid-career. The Marlborough Country campaign from 1964 was one of the most successful advertising campaigns ever. So this is 1964. "There's no such thing as Marlborough Country, but here I am anyway, knee-deep in powder, because today Marlborough Country is pure white, unspoiled and clear, the way your lungs would be if you didn't smoke. At least that's the idea. Imagine you're here with me in the middle of nowhere, where no one can see you light up against your doctor's orders. But this is 1964, and you're years away from all that, the cough and wheeze, the paper gown open at the back. Teenagers don't know how their health will be 15 years from now, any more than they plan beyond next week. They do what feels good, which means they play chicken in cars and impregnate their girlfriends. Someone has sprayed the trees with flame retardant to imitate fresh snow, choking the branches with thick white goo. I noticed a marker by the road a little ways off, the name's almost gone, a garland of plastic flowers bleached and chewed, hanging from a nail, the price tag still on." This is a final end of career poem about the Marlborough Man, in which he's giving his final interview. And the idea from this one came from a photograph of one of the models who'd actually played the Marlborough Man when he was younger. And he looked nothing like you imagine the Marlborough Man to look. His face was completely lined and craggy, and he just looked like an old guy.
Well, that's,
which we don't like to think about.
You can sort of count on that, can't you?
I guess we can. Yeah. This one's called "One More for the Road." "You feel so awful looking. You want to turn away, but you're transfixed. This is not a car crash, all twisted metal and flashing lights. This is my future, the one on TV I do for the money, because lung cancer wiped my savings out. Yes, that's right, despite what I said before. This is a sad interview with someone you don't know, the camera catching every aspect of my ravaged face in extreme close-up. Despite what the producer says, I refuse to adopt any of the old poses, light a cigarette, sing, or show my scars. He's frustrated, wants to do the bigger stories, reach ahead into the height of his career, and snatch back some of its glory to stuff in his pocket. The young interviewer has perfected her "there but for the grace of God go I" expression, which is not for me, but for the viewers at home, an important distinction I've employed to my shame too many times. She keeps mentioning irony like a hook to catch me on, but irony is a rusty concept these days, mostly mistaken for an unfortunate coincidence and popularized in the public opinion by shows like this. It's late afternoon, and outside I can see leaves turning in the breeze. You stare and stare, but I'm not there. I'm just another old man with thinning hair and big ears, anonymous at last, almost free.
It's the writing of Mickey Myers, reading from her book Trigger Finger and some newer poems. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
I want to make sure that we mention also again the reading you're doing at the University of Pittsburgh Bookstore for the Tea and Verse series, April 16th at lunchtime. And if you want more information, you can check out mickeymyers.com. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.